With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There we go, we're in business.
All right.
Sounding good. Well, I haven't seen you since I launched this podcast. That's how long it's been.
Well, that's how long it's been since my... Well, I saw you last in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but that was 2014.
Which
was three years before I launched this.
Okay, but I mean, my last UK tour was 2016.
Yeah, again, just before I launched.
Yeah,
that was the last time we saw each other.
4 years.
4 years. Coming up on five, I'd say.
Yeah. Wow.
It feels a lot longer as well.
It doesn't feel that long. It feels like I just seen you yesterday.
Does it?
Yeah.
Well, that's the sign of a good friendship.
Exactly.
Connected over the sea. We should start with your new film that you're over here promoting, Adverse.
Yeah.
You've gotten to work with my all-time acting hero.
Oh, and who might that be?
My number one dream podcast guest, Mickey Rourke. I honestly think he is just about one of the best to ever do it. I first saw his work in, what's the Rodriguez film? Once Upon a Time in Mexico was the first time I'd seen Mickey Rourke act. And I was like, who's this guy that just appears with a chihuahua in every scene? He was just this really enigmatic, fascinating character. And then Sin City followed shortly after that, where he was just an absolute powerhouse as Marv, and I became obsessed with him. Went down the rabbit hole, saw like The Pope of Greenwich Village, Rumblefish, Angel Heart, all these amazing performances he's put in over the years. The dude fascinates me, so I want to go in and get your first-hand account of what it was like doing scenes and working with a giant of acting like that.
Yeah, well, just to put a little bit of context of how I'm promoting the film over here, we just had our world premiere in Portugal, at Fantas Porto. It was the 40th anniversary of Fantas Porto.
And it's a festival that has a lot of prestige, doesn't it?
It does. We not only were selected to be in competition at the festival, but we were also selected to open the festival, which is the highest honor I think that you can get. So regardless of what awards we win or don't win, opening the festival was the prestige, because we're following in the footsteps of greatness.
Coen Brothers, No Country for Old Men, I saw was one of the films that opened.
Yeah, and that film went on to get 8 nominations and win 4 Oscars. Bong Joon-ho premiered The Host there. I think Martin Scorsese premiered Raging Bull there, which we just found out. James Cameron premiered a film there. Guillermo del Toro premiered a film. I mean, just the list goes on and on. Ridley Scott, I think, premiered Blade Runner there.
No way. So yeah, 40 years of kind of legit hits.
Yeah. So we had that honor and had our world premiere. And it's one of those things where maybe you haven't heard of it, but it's rated as one of the top 25 festivals in the world. So, yeah, Adverse is the name of the film, and I play the main protagonist, and Mickey Rourke plays the main antagonist. And
that is the main antagonist right there.
It truly is. He actually, when he read the script, he dropped out of another film to do our movie.
Because he was that drawn to the character and the story. Wow.
Yeah. I don't want to give too much away, but he really saw a lot of his brother in the character based upon some of the challenges that the character has. And again, I don't want to give too much away, for the film. No spoilers. We've only just had our world premiere. We don't have our release date yet, and we're doing the festival circuit. But he really was drawn to the character. It's a very layered character. It's not your typical bad guy.
Yeah, because that's my kind of sad issue with a lot of Mickey Rourke's work in, well, not even just recent years, throughout his career, is I think he's very often been relegated to quite two-dimensional roles because of the figure that he is within that industry, and I guess some of the bridges that he's burnt over the years. And I feel like a lot of the time his talent way surpasses the roles that he's given. And he always brings magic to the role, even if it is a fairly restricted, do you know what I mean, simplistic character that he's playing. So then it's always great when you see him with, you know, a role like The Wrestler.
Right.
Well, which has so much, as you say, layers and weight and depth.
And some of the critics are saying that this is his best performance since that movie.
Wow.
So, and Mickey, he brought it all. It wasn't like, he wasn't just phoning it in. Every day he was meeting with the director and talking about the scenes for at least, you know, half hour, an hour before they would even come on set. And they had reworked, you know, certain things to, you know, add those layers in even more than what was written, and just kind of delve into that. And, you know, he really emoted in the role, and it was quite amazing to watch.
Tell me about your first scene with him.
My first scene is that we shot. Yeah, the first scene in the film is my character plays a rideshare driver with a questionable past, and so I first take him on a ride as just a client before I really know anything about him or he knows anything about me or anything. But the first scene that we shoot is later on. We meet up again in the film, and at that point, already a lot of things have happened in the story, and basically my life is kind of on the line as his character. You know, again, I'm trying not to give too much away.
Trying to skirt around the details.
I'm skirting around the details of the story because I don't want to give away the story. But it's a very intense neo-noir scene where you're not sure
one-on-one.
You're not sure. Well,
don't be looking at my notes, Thomas.
No, that's fine. I'm not looking at your notes. I mean, there's one guy like, you know, dead in the corner already, and then his sidekick is with him. But the scene is really between the two of us, and you're not sure if he's going to kill me or hire me.
Wow.
So that's the first scene that we shot, and he was throwing curveballs at me, and I was just trying to keep up. And at one point he threw a line at me, and I'll never forgive myself for this one, because he asked me, it didn't end up making it in the script, but he ad-libbed, what's your mother's name? And I couldn't remember Penelope Ann Miller's character's name in that moment, because I wasn't expecting the question. And in that moment I realized, man, I have no business being an actor. I didn't even know my own mom's name. That should have, like, I should have had that.
Should have been in there in the pocket.
Yeah, he proved to me that he could dance circles around me right then. But I still stayed into the scene and tried to hold my own as best I could. But
did he vibe off you? Did he connect with you as an actor? Did you feel like there was a magic happening?
There was, I think, after the first cut. Like, we really didn't get introduced prior to that scene. And after the scene, the first take was done and they all cut, he kind of looked at me a little differently and kind of squinted his eyes, and then he introduced himself to me.
Like the seal of approval.
Yeah, it was.
Amazing.
Because it was kind of like prior to shooting the scene, he didn't care who I was.
Yeah.
And then afterward, he cared enough to introduce himself. So that was like, I was a big moment for me.
Incredible. Tell me about the filmmaker Brian. So is this the second film you've worked on with him?
Yeah, Brian and I,
Lost Tree, right?
We've known each other for a long time and worked on various inceptions of projects in different capacities. This may be our second one, but it really feels like the first one that we've really accomplished what we've set out to do as filmmakers.
And you're a producer on the film as well, we should say.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that hard, juggling two roles, being on set and being the business guy, but then also being the star and getting your acting chops up to speed, and then juggling the schedules and all of that? Is that a...
It can be challenging,
especially... hardy task some days?
Especially when playing a role that's vastly different than me. But because Brian also wrote the script, and knew the challenges that he was creating for me, we spent a lot of time in pre-production before we even got into like the whole casting thing of actually just focusing on the character and developing, you know, how he was going to talk and how he was going to walk and what attitude he was going to have and what ways he was going to be different than me. And really delving into the story shows a lot of his history. So it was kind of all spelled out for me, but even some of the things that we talked about ended up being put into later drafts, in regard to his history with his family and his mom and all that. And you know, the character really, it's not widely defined. It's only kind of just touched on. But when you start to find out what he's been through, you realize there's no possible way this guy isn't suffering from some sort of mental illness.
Well, they're always my favorite films when it's not spelled out and you have to kind of engage and work your mind and try and fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
You know, that's when, for me, cinema is at its best, when it is not a clear-cut case of, oh, I know exactly what this character is and what's driving and defining him. You have to invest in the story and go on that journey with him.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a line early on where Lou Diamond Phillips, who plays my...
That's a great name.
My character, my character's parole officer... asks Ethan, my character, if he's had any recent outbursts of anger. So it's kind of like you're wondering, like, oh, is this guy like an anger management guy? Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily realize that it's his, you know, parole officer. It's, again, it's not really spelled out as the film unfolds.
Brian, is he an actor as well? Is he in certain scenes in this film or in the Lost Tree film?
He is in this film.
Yeah.
And he studied actually extensively for about 3 or 4 years leading up into this one, mainly because of working together and sort of talking about how, you know, the best directors are the ones that can really communicate to actors.
Yeah.
And the only way a director, in my mind as an actor, can communicate to actors is if they understand the craft and the technique.
Yeah.
And so much so that Brian actually kind of broke my stride and my technique on this one and had me infusing techniques that prior to this film I was wholeheartedly against. I kind of studied under the Stanislavski techniques and was not a big fan of Meisner. And Brian did a lot of Meisner training, as well as other ones, and kind of roped me into some hybrid techniques where I was infusing some Meisner with my Stanislavski, which was a first for me, but it really accomplished some great things. So I owe a lot to Brian for drawing that out of me. And he did that because he put so much work and he's great in the film too. He plays, you know, one of the main henchmen that's kind of, you know, under Mickey Rourke's character.
Right. And how amazing is it to be almost 30 years into your career as an actor and still be learning and growing and developing?
I tell you, after working with Mickey, I want to go back to school.
Yeah. He's the king, man.
Yeah. No, and the stories he would tell, I don't want to, you know, I mean, I'm sure if you go and watch any of his interviews and
well, dude, he needs to come on this.
He talks about, you know, the other actors that he's danced around.
De Niro.
He's one of a kind. So intense and so just, yeah, he's one of a kind for sure.
What was Madsen like? Because again, he's another one of those figures for me that is a enigmatic powerhouse of a human as well as a performer. And his work, particularly in that 90s run from Reservoir Dogs and, you know, just again, a quite intense, I would imagine, character.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Madsen, no offense to Madsen, I mean, he doesn't hold a candle to Mickey, but, you know, who
does?
Well,
he's more of like a character actor, isn't he?
Right.
Madsen is, yeah.
But the cool thing for Madsen in the film that we did was that he wanted to, or he was willing to kind of go against type and not play just the bad guy, but be the caring father, which... You know, he really hadn't done in 15 plus years.
Yeah. Well, in Thelma and Louise, he's kind of that guy. Like, he's the good, loyal boyfriend.
Right.
And then after that, he was then just in Free Willy. He was the dad as well.
Right.
And then I guess he was just so great as Mr. Blonde that almost then typecast him as that type of convict, morally bankrupt right. very reprehensible, kind of gnarly dude.
Yeah, that's like his Tarantino go-to yeah. instant breakfast role. Yeah. So we definitely, Brian definitely got a different performance out of him for our work together. And it was good. He was great to work with. He was open to it and was excited to do something against type.
Did you get to spend much time with him off the set? Were you telling me, am I right in thinking this, that he has the car from Reservoir Dogs at his house on his drive?
He does. I didn't get to see that until I think we were doing some ADR for the film. And his schedule was kind of tight. So we had to schedule something that was near his house. And so we did, and then we were going to call the driver, and he's like, "Nah, just give me a ride home." So I did, and when we got to his house, yeah, that car was there right in his driveway.
That's one hell of a prop to take home, isn't it?
Right. I wonder if they let him or if he just drove off with it.
Yeah.
Because he told a great story about the way that scene ended up being in the film. Is the other actor, pardon me for not remembering his name, but the actor that played the cop that he's kidnapping in Reservoir Dogs.
Yep.
He wanted to feel what it was like to be in the trunk. And Madsen said, "Sure, no problem." And he closed him in the trunk, and then he got in the car and started going for a joyride. And the guy's like banging on the thing, and he pulled into a drive-thru and ordered a soda. And when he came back to set, the actor is in the trunk banging like, "Let me out of here!" And, you know, and Madsen just strolls out sipping
with
on a
the soda,
soda
yeah, as Mr. Blonde.
And the soda was not in the script, but when Tarantino saw this moment and the other actor, I mean, it's terrible what he did to him, but, you know, who would really in
great
their
result.
Right mind ask Madsen to lock them in the trunk of a car?
I heard that scene was the first example in cinematic history of the camera being placed inside the boot and that being the view out. That's something that I read. That was the first time that angle had ever been seen.
Oh, crazy.
There you go. Geek facts.
Geek facts.
How did you get your break in the business? How did it all start for you as an actor?
Man, my first speaking part was on television playing a young Tony Danza.
How old were you at the time?
I think I was 6.
Wow, that's so super young.
Yeah, 1986.
So how did that come about?
Same year that my son started and played... Zoe Deschanel and Jake Johnson's son on The New Girl.
She's just beautiful.
You know, he's actually, my son is in Adverse as well.
Really?
Yeah, he plays Matt Ryan's son.
Amazing.
Matt wanted to, he's one of the other henchmen of Mickey Rourke, and he wanted to round out his character a little bit and show, you know, a different side because he was a very cold, hard-edged character. You know him from like playing Constantine on television. He plays John Constantine on that short-lived series and now on like the DC universe or whatever. So Brian wrote in this scene and he's like, "Hey, Tom, we need to hire some kids." I was like, I know a kid.
He's ready to work.
Yeah.
So were your parents in the business?
My mom was pursuing a career and then got a job casting atmosphere in like some low-budget independents. And that was kind of how I got my first taste of being on set, of just being a background actor.
Right.
Is
that what atmosphere is, like an extra?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so like that's how I got my first experience of being on a set with, you know, 50 or 100 crew members creating this film. And just the energy and the way that it all works was, I instantly like was drawn to it like a fish to water. And bugged my mom about doing it again. And so, you know, she generated another opportunity for me and I still wanted to do more and pursue it. And that's how I first got my first agent and started going on auditions for actual, you know, featured parts, not just background parts.
That seems to me to be perhaps rare, certainly impressive and interesting that you have that drive and that innate taste for this craft, this lifestyle, this business at such a young age. Where do you think that came from? You just love the attention.
I'm not sure. I oftentimes will joke that I was more mature as a kid than I am now. And that really just stems from, you know, being...
You've got a lot of siblings, right?
I do, but I'm my mom's only son. So I kind of had a little bit of a, probably more so the only child scenario than the, you know, youngest of 7.
Right.
There were times, and I'm still, you know, close with my siblings, and there was times that I lived with them, but the majority of my time was just my mom and me. So I was, you know, at a young age, the quote unquote man of the house. And I think that being on a set, you know, it wasn't the same as being at school around your peers. You know, you
well,
were,
when you're a kid, you're the only adults that you're around are teachers, your parents, and your friends' parents. That's it.
Right.
Right. Whereas a film set, everybody's an adult. You're the only kid. And it's a totally like flip reverse case scenario.
Right. But you're around like a different mentality of adults. You're around, you know,
oh, the play
and technicians and artists and craftsmen.
Yep.
You know, it's not the same as like,
it's not bureaucratic.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. They're there and they're just, you know, it's the same way with my acting teacher of 10 years. He always spoke to me like I was my own person. He never looked down on me. Not to say that teachers do, because I met I had a few great ones in school, but by and large, they're not. By and large, they are speaking down to children.
Because they're the superior. And right. They're there to impart knowledge, and you're there to listen and observe and soak up and obey. And
on set, I was more of, you know, as long as I followed the rules and I wasn't the loudmouth kid when it was you were meant to be quiet, as long as I was smart enough to do that, then I was an equal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was smart enough to do that. I was smart enough to play when it was time to play and to toe the line when it was time to toe the line.
It's interesting what you say about that dynamic between yourself and your mother is, you know, when it comes to Rookie of the Year, which was, I guess, your first lead role breakthrough, there's, aside from the baseball in the storyline, there's this kind of very delicate, quite sensitive adult subtext between, you know, Henry's character, well, Henry the character and his mum, and the whole single parent thing. So did you bring a lot of your own experience into that?
Yeah, I would say that I did. And I had an interesting conversation a few years back with one of the producers of that. And he said that one of the main reasons that that film has stood the test of time the way that it has is not just because it's a baseball classic, because it's a fantasy, you know, in regard to baseball.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's totally fantastical. It's not.
It's Field of Dreams style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's not Moneyball.
Right. But it's but what makes it stand the test of time is Amy Morton's performance in that and the power that it gave single moms.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it really, you know, it just kind of showed, like, I don't know, there was a strength in her performance in that film, and how it turned out that, you know, she was the ball player all along.
Mm-hmm. And did you get a whole newfound sense of respect and understanding for your mother through the process of making that film? And did it allow you to appreciate parents more?
I mean, I always appreciated my mom in that respect, because she always did the same. She always treated me as an equal, and didn't, you know, speak down to me. And so, in that regard, I think during that film, I just kind of like grew up a little bit.
Were you 12 when you made it? Were you the same age as the character?
Yeah, yeah. I was 12. I was, you know, right at we shot it, September, October, November. I had just turned 12 the July before. But it was, you know, 3 months, 55 shooting days, and I worked 54.
Was it physically demanding?
Oh, for sure. I gave myself tendonitis during that film. Yeah.
Really? How? Just from pitching so hard?
From pitching so hard, and, you know, it was cold. By the time we got to Wrigley, it was the postseason. It was October, so Chicago was really cold. I had to go do school for 20-minute increments and then run back to set to shoot, and so there wasn't always enough time for me to warm up my arm. And then a lot of times they had me pitching no baseball so they could CGI it in. And when you don't have a field of resistance, also if you know anything about the mechanics of pitching, you want your arm to be as straight as possible. But if you know Henry's maneuver that Daniel Stern and I created, it's essentially called short arming. So you take short arming, and then you put no warm ups, and then you put no ball in my hand.
And being 12.
And there's the tendonitis.
And your body's growing and developing. And
yeah.
That's nuts. So they really worked you hard. They treated you like an adult in that sense as well. Like that we're not going to give you a pass because you're a minor.
There was no pass. I remember one moment in particular. I was doing a scene that ended up being cut from the film, ironically, where
ain't that always the way?
That's always the way. We leave the ball field after I've just thrown the ball from, you know, the center field bleachers to home plate, you know, the 300-foot throw. And then the friends are like, do it again. And they give me a rock. And then I throw the rock, and it's supposed to go faster than the L train in Chicago. So I'm throwing this rock by a Steadicam camera. So it's a hollow plastic rock, which, you know, has zero ability to resist the wind and just looks like a wobbly, ridiculous throw.
Yeah. It's like throwing a paper plate or something.
Pretty much. Yeah. And they're just like, it needs to be faster. It doesn't look fast enough. And so I was literally throwing my arm out.
You're like, just give me a real rock, guys.
Right. Well, I couldn't because I'm throwing it at camera. And I remember my arm was hurting so bad. And I was 12 and I was in tears. And the producer came over to me and he said, is this too much for you? And I kind of sniffled up. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, if it's too much, we totally understand. We're only a couple weeks into production and we can just call it quits. You can go home and we can start this over with someone else.
Wow. So they played that hardball with
like,
you at
and
that
I was
age.
Like, no, I'm good. Let's go.
I've got this.
And that's how I grew up.
And that is, I guess that is right there, an early introduction to the brutal nature of the industry. Did you find that, your experience making that film? You were like, this isn't just fun and games. This is a kind of dog-eat-dog world.
The reality of it is,
to get by.
The reality of it is that, you know, it doesn't matter what's kind of going on off camera or to get the shot. It's all about getting the shot.
And that's a good lesson to learn early on.
Yeah. It's also, you know, from the standpoint of, I mean, was he really willing to do that?
Or right.
Was
I
it
see
just
what
a
you
play?
Say.
You know what I mean? Just to get
those
the shot.
Tricks that you play on each other in that field, as you say, to get the scene,
right.
Which is what you're all there to get.
Yeah.
I mean, that cast, Gary Busey, that dude, I saw his work very early on. Under Siege was a movie that came out when I was, I think, about 11 or 12. And I was like, who is this maniac?
Well, come on, Music Man. You've seen Buddy Holly.
Not till much later on.
Oh, not till much
not
later.
Not till
okay.
much later on. But is he as insane as you think he is?
Probably more so.
Even more so.
But
his son's
during,
apparently wild as well. And
not as wild as him. No? I just saw Jake a couple months ago. I hadn't seen him in years. And no, he...
Is he around Jake, your age?
I think so. Maybe a couple years older, but he doesn't hold a candle to the energy that Gary had even back then.
And you had a lot of scenes with him. How was
oh,
it
yeah.
at that age working with a guy that larger than life, that off the rails?
You know, it was all right.
Good stories from set.
The biggest challenges I think were between him and Daniel Stern.
He
was nice to
other.
Me. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he once carried me by my underwear 25 feet across the lunchroom.
And that's him being nice.
Yeah.
There you go. Daniel Stern as well, people will know as Marv from Home Alone.
Of course.
Home Alone 1 and 2 had just come out before you went into filming that, right?
But he was also in Diner and
yeah.
Very
oh,
Bad
Diner's
Things.
The best. Don't be putting my 45s with my 78s. That character's so good.
Yeah.
What was he like as a director?
He was great. He was having a blast. And I think that the Brickma character that he plays in the film wasn't even in the script. That was sort of his like stress reliever role. So, you know, that zaniness is not him at all. He's
right. Okay.
He's a you know, a super caring person. It's funny too, because he had searched for the character for the actor to play Henry in LA and in Chicago and in New York. And they had seen, I want to say, like, it could be somewhere around like 1,500 kids, maybe more. And he was to the point where his son, who's actually a senator now, whose name is Henry, he was going to have his son play the role, who's only 10. So he's a little young for it. But he's like, listen, I know I can get what I want out of this character. And then it just so happened that I accidentally auditioned for the role twice. And on the second one, got the call back. And then
what did you do differently? You'll never know.
Nothing. Who knows?
He was just that at the end of his tether by that
Well, he
point.
Wasn't at the audition. It was with the casting director. I just went on the first call and didn't get the call back, and then was switching agents, and the new agent said, hey, we got this role, this audition for you. I said, oh, I already went on that. And she goes, well, they obviously don't remember you, so go again.
Brilliant.
So I
and
did.
Thank God you did.
Right?
How much did your life change after that film came out?
It was very strange.
Because it was a big movie, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it
yeah,
still
it
is a, like a kind of a
well,
classic.
It's just like American Pie. They were both sleeper hits.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And to define a sleeper hit, which I don't know if that's, maybe it's more widely known now. back then it was very much an industry term, kind of like, you know, when Fallout Boy, like number one with a bullet, you know, it's like an industry term that made it into their song of what the record companies would call a hit song. The sleeper hit is now we know like Marvel films that come out and they make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars opening weekend.
Instantly.
Right. A sleeper hit is when the thing kind of comes out, sort of does nominally well, and then the next weekend does the same, and then the next weekend does the same, and then just sort of stays and just keeps performing consistently. And Rookie of the Year and American Pie, the first one, both did that, where they didn't have, you know, their opening weekend was maybe like 10 million.
Yeah.
But then they did 10 million the next weekend, and then 10 million the following
Which
weekend.
Is in this industry rare.
Right. It's rare to be consistent. So that basically means that the opening weekend is the result of your press. The follow-up weekend is a result of the word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So and that just means that
the
both
audience
of them,
begins to, I guess, grow through word of mouth.
Right.
An organic discovery.
That's what keeps things, I think, you know, gives it staying power.
And in the age of DVDs and VHSs, obviously, they would then go on to find audiences in those platforms as well. Do you think that's still a thing? Do you think like the DVD audience has transferred in that sense, like a movie won't hit straight away but then we'll find it on Netflix? Do you think that's a thing anymore? Or
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say how much I'm aware of, you know, what the performance of films that are not necessarily super successful in the box office, because the box office is a really tough market right now. And someone was asking me this just the other day, and they said, oh, do you think that Netflix and Amazon are ruining the box office? And I said, no, because even Netflix and Amazon are putting things in theaters. I think what's ruining the box office is technology. And
lack of original ideas for me.
No, it's not even a lack of original ideas.
There is, remakes, sequels, prequels.
Sure,
too many of them.
But that's a separate conversation. The main thing is, look, we're in this hotel room right now. Look at the size of that television.
Yeah, it's a very nice TV.
I mean, that's like a 25-inch widescreen?
Yep.
Right? When I was a kid, you had a square.
That's a cinema right there.
Right. Like, so what I'm saying is, you know, you sit 10 feet away from a screen like that that you can buy for a couple hundred bucks. You spend a couple hundred more on a good sound system. You don't need to go to the theater.
Right.
It's technology and the availability.
Oh, so you don't mean the technology involved in filmmaking.
No,
you mean the technology involved in the consumption of film.
I mean, like, if you have great sound and a great picture at home and the quality is streaming in 4K or 2K, why do you want to go sit in a theater and listen to someone chewing popcorn really loud?
Yeah. Well, for me, music has the same thing, is you can't download that gig. You can download the song, but there's always going to be a place for live music and I think for cinematic releases, because it's about that collective experience, particularly with, in the case of film, I think horror and comedy are two of these genres that do so well in that scenario when there's loads of other people in the room with you to experience these heightened emotions.
Listen,
like, how often do you laugh out loud when you watch a comedy at home on your own?
I agree with you 100%, and sitting in that, you know, theater where we had to jump out in Porto to go do a couple of interviews, and we had like a live hit with like a TV show that was, you know, broadcasting our interview live throughout Portugal. So we had to go do that. And so then we were like, hey, we want to go and sit in the back of the theater and watch the audience react and see the vibe of what this is like, because that was our first time, you know, playing it in a theater full of hundreds of people. There wasn't a seat left. We actually had to like sit in like some sort of like sound booth chairs in the very, very back because they couldn't even find seats for us.
Amazing.
And so I'm all about that, you know, turn the lights down, sit in a crowded theater and experience something together.
Do you find yourself doing this? And I hate myself for doing it, but when I watch movies at home, I'm just constantly on my phone. I always do it. Whereas obviously in the cinema, wouldn't even dream ever of getting my phone out of my pocket. There's something to be said for that as well.
But that, I think, is what's going to drive us back to the theater.
Yeah.
Is that we all spend so much time on our devices that we're just missing life.
Yeah.
And if it takes a movie to like get us to turn our phone off for 2 hours, you know, granted you're staring at another screen, but it's not the same sort. It's a, you know, it's a story. It's an
emotion. Story. There's imagination. There's,
right.
Yeah.
There's a reaction. You're not getting an emotional reaction
from Twitter.
From
well, maybe from, you are. You today.
Well, yeah. Well, I was using Twitter as a device to speak my mind and get the attention of two companies that couldn't care less about me until I started actually lambasting them online.
And I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that they track down
my missing bags.
What's missing and return it to its rightful owner.
I mean, from the standpoint of the fact that they can't find my bags and it's been 3 days.
It's pretty disconcerting,
isn't it? I think
it's
pretty much going to be, in 2 days, I'm going to file like, here's a list of everything that was in there and the money you owe me.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to wait another 30 days for them to say, we still can't find it, and then they're going to pay me money. I mean, that's, fortunately, there wasn't anything that wasn't, irreplaceable in those bags.
And fortunately, you have all the tools that you need on you.
Yes.
To do what you're here to do, which is
that was,
play songs and
that
DJ.
That was the best. I got to the airport. Where was I? I went to Porto to Madrid, and I'm getting to load the plane I can't remember if it was Porto or Madrid. It's kind of like a whirlwind of travel today because I got like 2 hours of sleep and went to the airport at, 6:30 in the morning. But I'm standing at the gate, and the gate agent goes, "What's in your case?" I was like, "It's just my guitar." And she goes, "Oh, no, no. The rule of the airline is if you can take a musical instrument, but then you can only take one bag." And I said, "Lady, your airline lost two of my checked bags. You're not touching either one of these carry-ons. You're letting me on that plane." "Well, that's not the..." I go, "No, that's what's happening."
That's fair enough. I was coming back from a tour I just recently did, and I had a camera bag, and then I had my backpack with my laptop, and they were like, "One of those needs to go in the overhead." And I was like, "There's about £1,000 to £2,000 worth of equipment in each one. They're both staying by my feet." And they go, "Okay."
Right.
To go back to how your life changes, Rookie of the Year comes out. You're 13 by the time it's released. Is it hard to maintain a normal child life after, what you call a sleeper hit like that begins to draw attention to you as a face, as a recognizable personal figure? Can you still maintain anonymity as a kid and go about life as a teenager and enjoy the things that kids do? Or,
yeah, I mean, I think, I didn't have to quit it all like Henry did to get my kid life back.
Did you stay in school?
Yeah.
All of that? Yeah.
I stayed in school. I was actually... I booked the film, and it started 3 days before I was meant to start junior high school.
Right.
So, and in the States, junior high starts at seventh grade. So it was 3 days before I was going to a brand new school, and then I'm off to Chicago. And unbeknownst to me, they really set me up for failure at school because the homeroom teacher talked about me like filming this big Hollywood movie. So when I got to school, everyone was expecting me to be a jerk.
Right.
Just a full of myself kid, like, "Hey, look at me, I'm a star."
Spoiled little brat.
Right. And that's not my personality at all and never has been. So I learned the valuable lesson of, how to be perceived.
Yep.
And so...
Because people talk.
Right. And so it's the idea, obviously it takes a little bit more work to prove that you have your feet on the ground if people anticipate that you don't. In and amongst that, I kind of also learned that, it doesn't matter what you do, you can be a jerk and, and act like you own the world and have that mentality no matter what you do.
Yeah.
So I learned it's all about, like, if you do that, then you're going to draw more of those people, and then you're just going to have a bunch of false friendships. So when you stick to your guns and stay true to yourself, then you find the people that are also true to themselves, and then you find, real friends. And I'm still good friends with one of the guys I went to junior high school with.
Nice.
He was best man at my wedding, and now we both have two kids, and we were, just texting the other day, sending back pictures of our kids to each other and just playing a little catch up. Obviously, when you have two kids, you don't get to hang out as much.
No.
But we're still friends.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other thing, which we'll get to, I'm sure, soon down the line. What I wanted to talk about was the years in between Rookie of the Year and American Pie. Are you working a lot in that time? Is it easy to get work because this film has been a success and you're the lead role? Do you find your career is taking off, or is it a little bit slower than you would have anticipated? Or are you just focusing on being a kid, getting school done, and not trying to follow up on that with another success straight away?
I mean, I wasn't ever
you're
really
trying to juggle these kind of career choices, right, at a very young age. And
Yeah, but for me, it wasn't about like trying to achieve a success. In fact, the success of the film was so discombobulating at that age that I really steered away from even wanting to do press and further that idea. I just wanted to work.
Okay, so you didn't want to be a star. You just wanted to be an actor.
Right. And so I remember getting the next film, you know, doing like some guest spots on TV and things, and then getting the next movie. And then I remember my manager at the time was like, okay, now that the film's done, we're going to hire a publicist and we're going to start the campaign. And I was like, no, I'm good. He's like, well, that's going to mess up, you know, you getting work. I'm like, no, the work speaks for itself. I just want to work. And
that's a bold move.
Yeah, it didn't necessarily work out in my favor.
Right.
Because
in the short term, at least.
In the short term, no, because it did exactly that. It basically meant that, you know, I was not generating.
You didn't become the next Macaulay Culkin.
I wasn't taking enough selfies, essentially. Before selfies existed.
Were you friends with any other child actors like a Macaulay Culkin? Did you sort of group together with anyone like that? No,
I mean, I hung out with some people that were in the business, but it wasn't like my only go-to thing. I kind of steered away from anything in regard to that. I would go to an event if I got invited, but it wasn't my focal point. And so I did the sequel to then that film. So this was A Kid in King Arthur's Court and A Kid in Aladdin's Palace.
Yep.
And then at that point, I was about 15, turning 16, started focusing more on music and still doing, you know, guest spots, but just kind of trying to balance like my social life. I could drive now and then, you know, I had my band and I was still going on auditions and, you know, it was kind of doing a little bit of everything, but I definitely didn't focus enough on my career as an actor that it started to make my representatives really mad.
Right.
So I think, yeah, when I was about 17, about to turn 18, I had it in my mind that I was going to actually move to London.
Okay. To do what? To act? Or
no, I had done the ADR for A Kid in King Arthur's Court here, and we had to ADR everything.
What's ADR, sorry?
Audio dubbing recording. It's when you dub over your own voice.
Got it.
So A Kid in King Arthur's Court is a period piece. It's in the days of, you know, medieval times with King Arthur, and there's airplanes flying over like every scene where we shot it in Budapest, Hungary. So I had to ADR, I had to redub my own voice for 256 lines of dialogue.
Wow.
Which I did in 2.5 days. And I don't know if the engineer was joking or serious, but he was like, hey man, anytime you want a job here, because I was this, you know, 14-year-old kid. So in my mind, I was like, wow, that would be so cool. I'll move to London. I loved London.
Do voiceover work.
And work, yeah, do voiceover work. And then maybe like go do plays and pursue the craft and all that. And that was my plan. And then I booked American Pie.
Amazing. And again, you're the same age at that point in time as the character you're playing or thereabouts,
yep.
Right?
Exact age, yeah.
Was that the case with the whole cast? Were you all fairly of the same age group or were certain people? Because often, I think now and probably before that film, teenagers, and it's been taken the piss out of as well, are being played by like, you know, people in their late 20s or even older sometimes.
Well, they weren't older than that, but there were, I'm trying to think. I mean, Eddie K. Thomas was 17, which is why they can't show his scene of with Stifler's mom.
That's Finch right there. Yeah.
That's why this scene is off camera.
The snooker,
because it wasn't allowed.
Snooker table sex scene.
Because
right.
he wasn't
legally old enough.
Legally
to be
old enough to be, you know, performing with an adult. I want to say, you know, hate to
all this information is public, isn't it?
I think Sean William Scott was probably the oldest, if right. I'm not mistaken, and maybe Tara. And I want to say they were somewhere in their mid-20s,
right?
More or less. Maybe Tara not so much. I'm trying to think who else it was. There was a couple of people that were like somewhere around like 24, maybe. So, but not. Not that far off. What do you think about that age? We're only talking about 6 years.
Yeah.
It wasn't like anyone was like 32 playing, you know, high school.
What's going on over here? It's the Matthew McConaughey, isn't it? Haven't you got a Matthew McConaughey story we can get into quickly before we go back into the American Pie?
Sure. Let's see if...
All right.
Yeah.
So how did you meet him, first of all? How did you two...
Well, the first time I met him actually was at a Bruce Springsteen concert. I snuck backstage. to meet Bruce after he played at Dodger Stadium and to tell him that it was my dream with his blessing to play him in a movie one day. And he, you know, put his arm around me and
I can see that.
Looked at his manager and he goes, "What do you think? Do you think we look alike?" And his manager looked at him, looked at me, looked at him, looked at me and was speechless because, you know, we're about the same height.
Yep.
And, you know, if I jut my lower jaw out, I'm Bruce all the way. So I briefly met Matthew McConaughey there.
What year is this?
2006.
2006.
It was it was July 2006. And so cut to 2018, I was at CinemaCon in Las Vegas where they kind of launch, the studios present all their films that they're going to be coming out that year to all of the theater chains and get them kind of like amped up about what to expect that year. And I think he had White Boy Rick coming out. So he was there promoting that. And then there was this after party. And so everybody wanted to talk to Matthew McConaughey. And everyone was like clamoring around. And he's just like talking to the producers of the film and kind of ignoring this crowd of people around him. So I, of course, would have liked to have said hello. But I was like, I'm not going to go wait in line just so I can remind him of something that he might not remember. So I'm kind of maybe 10 feet or I'm outside the circle. And I'm just having a conversation with some theater owners that own an indie independent theater in like Maryland or something. And this one gal kind of is involved in our conversation. She's sort of nearby and says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to butt in." It's like, fine, we're just sitting here, you know, just shooting the breeze. We're just talking. So we start chatting about something. And then I think she says something about Matthew McConaughey, and I was like, "Oh!" And I told her, you know, I wanted to say hi because we met it like in 2006, and she starts arguing with me about the date of when that concert was, because apparently, like, it was something about like, yeah, she just starts arguing with me about the date, and then we start talking about like memory and dates, and then pretty soon we're talking about like remembering our own anniversaries of our respective marriages.
Uh-huh. I can see where this is going. I love it.
So I say how, you know, my wife and I decided on January 3rd. It's always a slow time in the industry for, you know, her touring and my filmmaking and touring. And so we were like, we will never forget this date. It's always, you know, a couple days after New Year's. And then she tells this story about her and her husband arguing about their date of their marriage and that they opened up a drawer in the kitchen and there was a koozie from the marriage and they were both wrong about the date they were married. So I don't realize who this person is. but I know that essentially, unbeknownst to me, Matthew looks over in our direction and then looks to another person who is assumingly maybe his publicist or manager or someone who then shoots a look at her and she just abruptly leaves the conversation. Very like odd to be mid conversation and then someone just kind of darts
cuts,
out without
cuts
saying,
the cord, exits.
Yeah, cuts the cord, exits, doesn't say goodbye. So I didn't realize that this was Camilla, Matthew McConaughey's wife. So party's kind of winding down. The crowd of people have gotten to say their quick hellos to Matthew or have given up. And there's maybe a few stragglers and I'm standing over kind of in the same area. And all of a sudden, Matthew and Camilla, in tow, he beelines it right at me. Just coming like daggers, like coming right at me like he's going to bowl me over. And he walks up and I'm like, "Oh, cool. I'll get to say hi to Matthew McConaughey," right? And so he looks at me and he goes, "I saw you talking to my wife." And I said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Well, you know, we were just talking about how I had briefly met you. I don't expect you to remember in 06 at the Bruce Springsteen concert." He's like, "Springsteen, huh?" I was like, "Yeah, you know, the big man was still there. You know, we both met, you know, Clarence." He's like, "The big man." And I was like, "Yeah, you know, the sax player, like he was still alive then. And, you know, anyway, it's good to see you again." He goes, "All right, all right, all right." And he walks away. But he was definitely
and coming to kick your ass.
Yes, yes, because apparently, unbeknownst to me, he is outspoken about being territorial and
right.
being
he's just a jealous guy.
Yeah, he has said this, and it was brought to my attention after this moment because I was like, "What the heck does
happen?" I just love that all he needed to do was shoot his publicist a look that she then did to the wife, and she's like, "Out."
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah. Because he basically was like,
he's got a whole system in place.
The whole system. Because like I said, because I was like, what just happened? Did Matthew McConaughey just try to kick my ass? And they're like, yeah, he's pretty, like, he's a jealous person, and he has stated so, that is him. So I avoided an ass whooping by Matthew McConaughey.
I just love that even in that moment of anger, he still reverted to, all right, all right, all right.
He did. I don't think he really meant to, but I mean, it's just funny that only me
would be. Is he a big dude? Does he impose?
No, I mean, he's like the same size as me. I could have taken him.
Right, yeah.
Only I would have the experience where I'm speaking to someone's wife about our respective dates of marriage.
Yep.
And then I get a potential ass whooping by their spouse.
Amazing. And the spouse happens to be Matthew McConaughey.
And I wanted, at that moment, I mean, if things had progressed further, I would have been like, I can't remember the date now, but I think at the time I would have remembered like the date. I'd been like,
yeah,
you know, I actually know when you two got married. Do you?
Yeah. Then you'd have definitely gone to fist.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Would have been a great story though.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Were you guys on set workshopping a lot and doing bonding team building exercises in the process of making American Pie? Because with ensemble films like that, I really feel like the magic comes to light when there's genuine friendships there. And I think for me, that film, it came out at a time when I was, I think, 13 or 14. So it was just the exact right age for a film like that. It captured all the clothes, the music, the culture. It was just, you know, a beautiful time for alternative music, which was so entrenched in the soundtrack to that film. And obviously, you know, these kind of gross, crass, funny teen comedies are perfect for a teenager to consume. But I think what marked out that film as being separate from a lot of others that preceded it and came after was the heart and the real, genuine kind of relationships that these, particularly the male characters, share with each other. And I think we've spoken about this before, but for me, there was a real coming of age tenderness to that film. So did you guys do a lot of workshopping and bonding in the lead up to shooting, and did you indeed become, you know, like genuine real friends on the set?
I mean, I think,
how did it work?
Well, first of all, Paul and Chris Weitz, who directed the film,
it their first movie?
It was their first directing job.
Yeah. And was the screenwriter the first time writer?
First
time
writer Adam Herz. Yeah. I think prior to that, Chris and Paul had written the movie Ants.
Right.
And so their focus, and especially more Paul was very much focused on like the character development and, you know, what each character represented and what their backstory would be. And Chris was definitely more focused on, you know, the punchlines,
the
comedy aspect. So they were a great team in that regard.
Yeah. So that's why it has both, because they had two guys and one had each corner covered.
Exactly. And then as far as the rehearsal process, once the cast was locked and loaded, we did about 2 weeks of rehearsals, which I think rehearsals with, and it was like a mix and match. So like, you know, the first day was everyone together doing a big table reading. And then they kind of broke everything off and they would do different groupings. So like some days I would go to rehearse and it would just be, you know, Tara and me for like a half a day. Other times it would be, you know, with Jason and Chris and Eddie. And it was always different inceptions of that. And we would spend time working on the scenes and we would talk about the characters and we would, you know, go out for lunch and, you know, just kind of have that hang time. And I've always said that, you know, you give an actor, you know, 2 days of that rehearsal and they'll give you, you know, 2 months of history.
Yeah.
So you give someone,
'cause it's real.
You give someone 2 weeks and now all of a sudden they can give you 2 years mm-hmm. of history. So it definitely gave us a lot to connect off of. And now that you mention this, I realize how much J.B. Rogers was following in suit when we did the sequel, because he would bring us in for rehearsal and we wouldn't even really rehearse the things. We would just like hang out and go to strip clubs.
Amazing.
You know,
sounds like a really hard gig.
Yeah. But he would, because he was just kind of like, you guys already know these characters. And I realized as you're saying this, it was all just about us spending that time together, because that's the energy. That's what makes even this interview so much more important, or I don't know, brings so much more life to it than us doing it over the phone.
Yeah. Exactly. Face-to-face and real-life connection and history all combined.
What's that? It's that vibration, you know what I mean? Like, it's that's why we're, like, you know, you say when you're hanging with someone, you're vibing.
Mm-hmm,
you can't get that vibe
I never do podcasts on the phone. I used to obviously do phoner interviews when I was working on Kerrang, because that was a necessary part of it. Is you're playing new music all the time. You want to get the latest single from 30 Seconds to Mars. Let's chat to Jared Leto for 5 minutes, and you can do that. Whereas I think with especially a style of a show like this, where it's hopefully a lot more conversational and in-depth, if you don't have the person there in front of you, there isn't that same spark. Who did you connect with the most?
Man, I think probably, you know, during the film, there's different sorts of inceptions. So like, you know, during the film, I was very much focused on the sort of history of Kevin and kind of connecting with Tara, and then also, you know, with the boys. But see, Jason and Eddie were kind of already friends beforehand.
Were they coming from a New York East Coast?
Yeah, a little bit of that
background.
You know, obviously I knew Chris Owen, who played the Shermanator, and there was, you know, a couple little like other minor roles where I knew some of the people. It was probably afterwards when we were doing the press tour, and we're once again, even though I
was that a fun. Were you doing like all over the world together?
We did some areas more. Some of the other cast went to other places. I kind of did my same.
Used the same tactic. Everybody else is on the publicity train.
I didn't hire a publicist.
You stepped back.
I stepped back, which again cost me follow up roles.
Well, yeah, I think after that film, obviously, you know, I think Sean William Scott would probably be the biggest quote unquote success story.
Right,
but then
Jason went on to do a bunch of films.
Of course,
I don't necessarily know that they performed as well as the studios wanted them to. Tara went on to do other films. I mean, she did Josie and the Pussycats after that. You know, obviously Allison had already done
Buffy
and then, you know, went on later to do, but How I Met Your Mother was way later.
But I always feel like with those guys, their roles that followed, and this is with all due respect, their roles that followed on from American Pie were always fairly similar to their characters in that film, because a lot of those characters were so good and so larger than life.
Well, that's,
was it hard for those guys, do you think, to step away from those roles?
I couldn't speak for them in regard to that. I mean, I can only probably, you know, surmise from the same, you know, perspective that you can about what they have done and what the outside perspective of that is.
Well, I mean, sure, William Scott, a character like Stifler must be a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, he must. How could he not feel that way? You know, he's a very positive person, so he would never like divulge that kind of information
or be down on that character for the success that it's afforded him. Yeah,
yeah. Because I mean, I remember even when we were shooting American Pie 2, I had like grabbed this script and it was a very different type of role, and I was seeing what he kind of wanted to do. I already had like my producing kind of hat on at that time, and you know, he was really non-committal on it. He was just kind of like in for anything. But I would say that I can, from my own perspective, I think that I achieved the same short-term low result, but long-term high result, which is by not hiring a publicist and by not going out of my way to advertise that character that I played, I didn't cement immediate roles that would have probably been similar.
Yeah. Well, also, that character wasn't as... Again, I say this with all due respect because I love all the movies and all the people in it and the characters that they play. But I think Kevin was very much quote unquote the normal person in a sea of very
well. Here's the thing:
exaggerated, over the top characters. Do you know what I mean? He was like the kind of the
but that's
the
what,
gel that held the group together.
But that's why the film works.
Yeah,
because in that scenario, every time I've ever seen a teen sex comedy, no one wants to be the backbone.
No one wants to be the straight guy.
Everyone wants to be, you know, the highlight.
Yeah.
So that's why American Pie worked. And that's what Paul Weitz and I really worked on, was the emotional standing and the dramatic history of Kevin and why he chose the things that he chose.
Yeah.
And who he was as a person and what his backstory was. I mean, you wouldn't think that in a comedy you'd write, you know, a serious backstory about, like, whether or not Kevin's, you know, parents had split up and why they had split up and what he really felt about the term "I love you" and why he didn't want to say it, you know?
Yeah. And because that's established in the opening scene, isn't it?
Right.
Is she's like, "I love you." And he's like, and he,
but it's not for the
it
sake,
hard to say.
It's not for the sake of comedy. It's coming from the standpoint of,
it's emotionally torn.
His deep seated, you know, want to only say it when he actually means it, which he later reveals. But it's coming from like a deep rooted history that we carved out and wrote for that character.
A place of conflict.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, I think it worked out in the long run, because I've been afforded the opportunity to play very different roles, to the point where it's always been my goal to be unrecognizable. Even when I was
like a Dustin Hoffman type.
Even when I was in Porto, some people didn't put two and two together. I mean, yeah, granted, when I go on the stage and introduce the film,
yeah.
They know that that's me.
I'd be worried if they didn't know that stage.
But there was a moment where I ran into some of the people that at the festival, and they looked at me and they said, "Oh," because I talked to Brian, and they said, "Oh, who are you?" And they're like, "Oh, you're Thomas. Oh, they didn't like put it together." And
you take that as a compliment. You're
absolutely
like, great.
Yeah. I mean, Brian has shown the film to industry professionals who say, "Oh, I thought that you said your business partner's in this movie."
Yeah.
And I'm the main protagonist. Yeah.
No, he is.
Yeah. Or like, you know, like I had told you, we were talking about films like playing Walt Disney.
Yep.
That is a
great
vastly
film,
different
great
look
role
for me.
Yeah. And the one I wanted to talk to you about in a moment, Simon, but I want to stay on American Pie for a moment.
Yeah.
When you come back to make the second film, is there a pressure there? Is there an expectation? Because that first one obviously wasn't an overnight success, but did become huge. And, you know, had even like terms which were probably now in the dictionary, MILF, things like this. Like,
right.
It was this huge phenomenon. So when you come back to make the sequel, is there pressure on set? Do you feel like we had a special film here, we don't want to fuck this up? Because for me, there's so few comedies that have sequels that are on par or better than the original. I think American Pie 2 succeeds on both. I think it's bigger and better, and the heart's still there. And, you know, in the way that the first movie captures high school adolescent, that college era storyline really taps into the whole wear and pull and kind of how people's lives change and people grow apart and trying to make sense of all that. So I think it delivered on every sense. But did you all feel as a cast and crew on set, like, let's not fuck this up?
Well, there was a lot of things, a lot of factors that helped us, hurt us, and that we fought against. The first thing is the studio first tried to hire a different writer, and he tanked his rendition of the film. And so they had to bring in Adam Herz.
Right. So he wrote the second film, but the directors didn't come back to direct.
Correct.
Yep.
And so then, you know, he...
Are they still involved as producers or anything?
They
or?
Were still involved as producers, right. Still kind of there helping to make sure that we, you know, stayed on point to what they had helped create.
Yep.
But not wanting to pigeonhole themselves as only being known as those
of course.
Types of directors.
Well, then they did About a Boy
right.
soon afterwards. Totally different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, Adam was writing from, because he based all these characters on his real friends. And so that lake house is what they did, and paint houses to pay
he
for the lake
house.
He
must have had a great childhood.
So, you know, that he was right. You know, they say write what you know. Well, Adam was writing what he knew.
Yeah.
The other element of it that, you know, is sad to say, I mean, it was great that may he rest in peace, that I got to work with him, was Chris Penn.
Chris Penn.
Yeah.
What's his involvement in it?
So Sean Penn's brother, Chris Penn, was hired as Stifler's dad in American Pie 2.
Wow.
So it was great to work with Chris. He was not necessarily the right tonality for the film.
Because he's terrifying.
It's not so much that he's terrifying. There's just, yeah, there's a fine line of being able to pull off that kind of comedy where you can speak so terribly and have it be funny and not sad. And there was an element of sadness that somehow started where you started to actually feel terrible for, like, Stifler. And that was not the you know, the idea, the nomenclature that we wanted to have, or that Sean wanted to have, or that the studio wanted to have. And ultimately, unfortunately, got cut from the film entirely.
I never, is that like public knowledge? Has that been spoken about? I never knew that.
It's been spoken about. Yeah. Wow. I never knew that. At various times. Wow. Not widely known.
Yeah.
I mean, the real reality of it is, and no offense to Chris, because he was a very, very awesome person.
So you got to do some scenes with him as well, yeah?
I didn't really have very many scenes with him, but right. I definitely took the opportunity to hang out with him on set. I mean, it's
was
Chris
he great?
Patton. Yeah, he was great. He was just on like the re-kick, you know. He was getting back in shape and, you know, had quit drinking, and he was actually like, we were shooting in Malibu, so he was staying at his mom's house and like running in the morning to set, and, you know, he was all about it. Originally they had reached out to and let's see if I'm getting this right, Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
Wait, is he still? No.
He recently passed
as well. He recently passed as well, right?
About 18 months to 2 years ago.
We're talking about two guys that are not with us anymore. This is terrible. But remember his role as Chet.
Yeah, of course.
In Weird Science.
Of course.
So that was the Stifler's dad model. And he, unfortunately, had just directed Frailty and was in post-production. And he was like, there's no possible way I could do post-production as the director
on
Frailty and come reprise, you know, essentially Chet from Weird Science to be Stifler's dad. But he had the right tonality. If Chet had been Stifler's dad, those scenes would have worked. It just didn't work with Chris.
I like that there's a lot of tip of the hats to the likes of Fast Times at Ridgemont High and those kind of high school films in American Pie as well. It's not over the top. And if you don't know that world, it's not going to jump out at you. But especially with the surrealistic elements that you kind of, again, it's hard to balance that, I think, a heartfelt storyline with, you know, like the Sex Bible book.
Right.
And moments like that that are obviously so absurd and, you know, completely fake. But then they sit in this world, and obviously Casey Affleck as well as your big bro. Did you ever get to speak on the phone actually to him in those scenes?
No, we shot them on completely different days both times.
Right.
Both films. I think the only time that I met him was at the premiere of the first American Pie. I didn't even meet him during rehearsal.
Was he like a big star at that point? Had he done...
No, I don't think so.
Many successful films? I think what was the one he did in the 90s, To Die For, right, with Joaquin Phoenix and Nicole Kidman?
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd
been in a few bits here and there.
He'd done that. He was established, but it certainly wasn't like, you know, he hadn't gone on to, you know, I mean, you know, obviously later Manchester by the Sea,
of course,
winning the Oscar.
Yeah. And, was Good Will Hunting out?
Good Will Hunting?
By that point. I know he's only a fairly small role in that, but...
Because
he was known, was he? Did he feel like a kind of a star cameo? I think it was maybe 97.
Yeah, I guess that had come out. He was in that, because I mean, I remember it was a pretty big deal because his brother came to the premiere of American Pie. I don't think Matt Damon was there, but Ben was. So that was kind of a trip. And then I don't even think I like went over and said hi because I was like,
did you say hello to Casey though?
Briefly,
I'm your brother. He's like, who?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't even actually remember the encounter. I mean, there was crazy amounts of people that were there. I mean, Dustin Hoffman was there.
Well, it was, like I said, just a huge film. I don't think there's been another good high school comedy film since that. Like, for me, it stands up with the Fast Times at Ridgemont High and the Porky's. And...
Well, the tonality has just changed, and I don't think, you know, in all fairness, it was even changing then. Because the original script was Kevin leading in and out the story, and it was focused more on
the friendships and the
friendship and just the through line and the emotional backbone of the story and the coming of age part of it. And it was only like right as we were about to shoot it that they flopped it and put Jim as the opener and closer and decided to focus more on the comedy, which in my mind really worked on the first one. If you notice, Kevin has the most screen time because it was his story.
Well, by the time you get to the third film,
yeah,
you're in like 2 minutes worth of film.
I have 17 lines of dialogue really? In the third film. I was counting.
I'm not just saying this because you're here. I don't think the third one worked for me.
No, the third one was
the first two, I think, were amazing. The third was the least of the whole four, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my least favorite of all of them, for sure. I mean, the whole flip-flop of, you know, Sean and Eddie or Stifler and Finch doing that whole thing was completely outlandish.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost like
when it became Will Ferrell over-the-top kind of comedy.
But that's what Jesse Dillon was going for.
With the gay dance-off scene in the club
He wanted it to be like, you know,
an old-school Ben Stiller
comedy.
Yeah. Yep.
He wanted it to be like Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I'm saying is that even in 99, it was starting to shift out of the, you know, let's focus on the emotional to let's focus on the comedic aspects.
And ham it up. Yeah.
Yeah. And then from there, it went farther. I mean, you know, Judd Apatow came in and Seth Rogen and, you know, just like really went to like the outlandish. Don't get me wrong. I love watching those films. I've seen them all and seen them in the theater.
Well, you got
and
to
I
do one
them.
As well, the Franco film, Zeroville.
We don't need to talk about that. Okay. I mean, it was great that I got to play Martin Scorsese, but the film, I mean, I'm only in like
a tiny scene where it's the 70s directors, Lucas, Spielberg. And
I mean, if we were there, I was there for like a few hours. It took me longer in the hair and makeup trailer getting my beard on than it did to shoot the scene. And the film was widely panned. So thank God I'm barely in it.
Yeah.
So we don't need to talk about that one.
Yeah, but backtracking, you felt like at that point in time it was becoming more let's go loud, let's go big, let's go over the top. And you could feel that change happening.
For sure.
In the moment, could you?
Yeah. But I mean, I wasn't going to try to play into that because that's my strong point is drama, and that's where I'm finally getting back to my roots and what I want to do as an actor.
Well, you got to do around the time of American Pie, you got to kind of branch out with The Rules of Attraction, which I just watched for the first time the other day. I'd never seen it. A wild kind of very stylistic, obviously it's a Bret Easton Ellis. What's the guy's name? Bret Easton Ellis.
Adaptation, yeah? Yes, by Roger Avery, who wrote Pulp Fiction with Tarantino.
Yeah, and he did Killing Zoe as well.
Yeah.
So you've got pedigree right there. You've got James Van Der Beek, who was obviously Dawson at that point.
Well, and the whole cast is like a WB's Jessica Biel dream. And, you know, it's all like the, you know, these like TV stars.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you got like, like you said, Jessica Biel and... Fred Savage is in there and
it's just drugs and carnage. A very tonally different film to American Pie. Did it come out just after the second American Pie film?
Yeah.
Was it around that time?
It was around that time. I did like, that was a busy year where I shot in 2001, I shot American Pie 2, Rules of Attraction, Stealing Sinatra, and Halloween Resurrection.
Wow.
I think like all in the same year. It was like, or a year period of time. It was crazy.
I want to talk to you about Stealing Sinatra in a bit, but let's go back to Rules of Attraction and working on that set. What was Roger Avery like to work with? And did you get to kind of understand the dynamic between him and Tarantino? Because was that a friendship that started out kind of strong and then went south? And
well,
was there a feeling like he had something to prove?
No. I mean, they worked at a video store together.
Yeah, and that's where they co-wrote Pulp Fiction, right, in their days.
And then, you know, I mean, he had great stories about, you know, being in there and, you know, guys would bring in like an eight ball and they'd be like, free movie rentals for a week for you. and I think, you know, at the time he didn't even really understand that things were shot on 35 millimeter. They, you know, because they worked in this video store. Neither one of them really understood that, you know, out the gate. I mean, obviously they learned it because they were studying all these movies.
Yeah.
But I mean, Roger Avery wrote the John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson storyline of Pulp Fiction. And you can see that clearly since that point that Tarantino's style went to like, he wrote the whole Bruce Willis, you know, kind of thing.
More fantastical.
Fantastical and the S&M and like it gets into like the really, you know, uber violent. I mean, granted, you know, it's obviously vastly violent when they accidentally blow the guy's head off in the car.
Yeah.
That's still Roger.
Yeah.
But Roger has a different tonality. It's not as fantastical. It's more based in reality. And I think that their major falling out happened with True Romance.
Okay. My favorite film of all time. Please divulge anything you can.
Well, the story goes...
I know that he wrote Natural Born Killers and True Romance and then used the money from those two scripts to make Reservoir Dogs, right? Is that kind of how it happened?
I'm not sure of Tarantino's thing. I'm only speaking of the falling out of Tarantino and
did he
Roger
basically
Avery.
Just write Roger Avery out of
no,
that script?
No, he couldn't come up with the ending for True Romance, and so he promised Roger that he would let him direct True Romance if he wrote the ending for him.
Right.
So Roger wrote him the ending, and then Tarantino didn't keep his promise.
Right.
And that's the basis of their entire falling out.
And I kind of think fair enough. What right. do you think?
Yeah. What would you do if, you know, I mean, you love True Romance, right?
I love it. It's my favorite film of all time.
How is it possible that someone could ask a friend, hey, help me finish this thing and I'll give you something in return, takes what he gets and then says, screw you.
That's cold.
at least at some point you'd say, hey, let me make it up to you. I'm sorry I did that. I was just trying to, like, you know, get ahead. But from there, it was just a direct break.
Yeah. But the flip side to that is that I think Tony Scott's style adds a very glossy, romantic, really cool feel to that film.
Sure.
Right? And it would have been a totally different film if Tarantino would have made it.
Well, I'm kind of glad he didn't. You mean if Roger Avery directed it?
Or Tarantino.
Right.
Anyone other than Tony Scott, I think, he really gives that film, again, a heart. And I think the Clarence and Alabama love story, although there's these fantastical, violent, crazy details there, at the heart of that story, you totally buy into the affection that these two characters have for each other, and you're rooting for them through the journey. But
working with Roger was incredible. I actually...
cool guy.
Yeah, I auditioned for a different role in the film, and... he didn't think that I looked the right way for that role. So he called me and said, hey, listen, I know, you know, you wanted this character. And so I totally understand if you want to say no, would you consider playing this role? And I said, yes, of course. Because in my mind, you know, getting to work with him, any size role, was a great opportunity. And so it was one of those crazy things where it was my first time playing with dramatic improv on camera. I'd done it in class. It was part of, like, my repertoire and my techniques, but to actually pull off dramatic improv is a different standpoint while the camera's rolling.
And there's a whole crew around you and
was his whole thing. He would tell me one thing and say, don't tell James. And then he would tell Vanderbeek another thing and he would tell him, don't tell Tom. And then we'd do the rehearsal as scripted. And then when the first take would go, then all hell would break loose. And we'd do the things that Roger told us to do. And it would change the scene. And it would be completely natural. All the fear and everything. And the you know.
It's like organized chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the feel of the film, isn't it?
Right.
I read that Bret Easton Ellis is most fond of that film out of all the adaptations that have been done. Even American Psycho. He's like, that film for me captures the spirit of the book the most.
We almost had Christian Bale reprise
Patrick Bateman because James Van Der Beek's character is his brother, right?
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah, he was unfortunately shooting something else at the time and the dates couldn't work out, but he had agreed to do it for Roger and then wasn't available.
What was it like working with James? Was he cool? Was he like a very gifted actor? Did you feel like you and him could kind of create pretty magical moments together working on that film?
Yeah, I mean, the majority of my stuff, I mean, obviously I had the big, like, drug raid with him and Clifton Collins Jr.
Yep.
And then my other scenes were with Ian Somerhalder. I mean, really, for me, it was all just about, like, trusting the hands of, like, Roger Avery, because he was the mastermind behind it. And he would just pull stuff. You never knew what was going to happen when the camera was rolling for him to get... you know, within reason, outside of, like, I mean, I remember at one point when I knock on the door to the drug house, Roger had Clifton Collins Jr. answer the door with the gun pointed at my head. Like, I didn't know that was going to happen.
He's brilliant in that film. He's unhinged.
Yeah. He was definitely channeling Samuel L. Jackson for sure.
All the European stuff, I was reading that Roger just funded himself as well, right? He just went around the world with a video camera, just...
Oh, the all the stuff with Kip Purdue.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they just went on like a... I don't even know.
And he
like
was apparently in character
journey.
The whole time. Just
yeah. Yeah, it's a crazy story.
I want to talk to you about... I watched the film today at your suggestion. Please Give, right?
Okay.
Very Woody Allen-esque. Very American, East Coast, indie feel. Some amazing actors in there. List off some of the names in there. I've got them written down here because there's so many.
Yeah, well, I mean, the main ones I play...
Catherine Keener.
Catherine Keener, which
is
like...
She is incredible.
Yeah. Well, and she's kind of the go-to for Nicole Holofcener, the writer-director of the film.
Right.
They've worked together quite a lot. Oliver Platt's in the film. Amanda
He's so
Pete.
Good. He's so good.
And then I play Rebecca Hall's love interest.
Who's the dude that's in Buffalo 66 and loads of independent films?
Oh,
Kevin Corrigan.
Yes, Kevin Corrigan. Yeah.
Every like scene, there's a new kind of indie superstar that turns up, and you're just like, wow.
That's what happens when you shoot in New York.
Who's your love interest as well? What's her name?
Rebecca Hall.
Rebecca Hall.
Yeah.
Incredible as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if she had done even The Prestige at that point. I'm not sure. With Christian Bale and
she's done so many great films since.
Yeah,
and
Hugh Jackman.
So,
yeah,
so great in everything.
Yeah, she's phenomenal, and you know, and she's doing an American accent like flawlessly. And she's not quite that much taller than me. There were a lot of scenes,
a lot of jokes about he's too short. He's too short.
There's a lot of scenes where they put her on an apple box.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just to like really sell the whole thing. Because Nicole Holofcener kept like trying to find short actors, but she often thought that their arms were really short. So she kind of like let me get away with a couple of inches. I was a little too tall for the role, but
she
made it work.
With apple boxes.
Yeah,
incredible. With apple boxes. Was that a very different experience to a lot of the Hollywood, LA, West Coast sets?
Yeah.
Was it a completely different feel?
Completely different feel. I think it's quite honestly... one of my most honest performances, and when I say that, it was really the idea in that particular film to peel away any pretense of acting and to just be, and that's what I think gives it that, you know, like you said, that Woody Allen kind of feel, is that everyone is just very relaxed,
yeah,
and just sort of present.
And it's an East Coast feel, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me because there's such a distinct difference between these kind of indie West Coast films and the indie East Coast films, like a Tarantino and a Jarmusch, for instance.
Right.
Obviously, Tarantino is no longer indie, but you know, it's just such a different sensibility, isn't it? Do you think it stems from the school of both acting and filmmaking and how they differ? And you think it's more about the stage element in the East Coast and people are a lot more perhaps theatre trained, and what do you think it is? Or is it just the geographical, sociological differences?
Yeah, it's a little bit of that. I mean, I think, you know, I have my weather theory between the differences of LA and New York.
Right. It's cold, so everyone's in a rush. And
No. It's it's in LA, in Los Angeles, the weather's typically very good all the time.
Of course, yeah.
So
that's what I mean. In New York, it's cold, so everybody...
You become very full of yourself, like you have a false sense of control.
Right.
Almost like a god complex,
mm-hmm.
and therefore everything's sort of okay, and then you'll sort of talk about someone behind their back because everything's like it's okay face to face. In New York, you're reminded that God exists because he's dumping on you with the weather,
yep.
And just, you know, reminding you that you're not in control, and so therefore it creates a more honest nature where people are like, I don't have time for this. I either like you, and if I like you, I'll treat you well. And if I don't like you, I'll let you know. And you'll know what you're going to get right now.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, the main difference between the West Coast and the East Coast. That's my weather theory.
I just did a tour with Zach Wilde, and his personal security guard is this ex-NYPD homicide detective, as East Coast as they come, and so funny. And I'd never met anyone like him before because most of the Americans that I know are West Coast people from California and places like that, and getting to spend time with a proper like New Yorker, I was like, I've got to go to that city. I've never been.
You've never been to New York?
I've never been to New York.
Oh, dude.
I need to go.
It's an experience. It was probably only like when the iPhone came out that I finally wasn't scared to death of New York. Because when the iPhone came out, then I could figure out the transit system.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I got on like the subway going the wrong direction for miles.
And then wake up, where the fuck am I?
Right. Well, you'd end up in Queens and you're like, ah. Or you'd end up in, you know, the Bronx, or you'd end up in, you know, whatever it is. You just end up in the wrong spot. And then you'd exit out of the train and you're like, crap, where am I? So the iPhone made New York less daunting for me.
Were you born in LA?
Pretty much.
Yeah. So the West Coast has always been
your
spiritual home, if not your geographical.
Yeah, I was born in Vegas, lived in Northern California, and then moved to LA when I was about 6.
Vegas. Wow.
Yeah.
Do you go back there often? Have you got an affinity for Vegas? Have you still got a lot of family there?
I have family there, so I have an affinity for it. My brain was really formed in Northern California, in Santa Cruz. I think that's where my sort of cadence of life comes from, in that more laid back sense.
I can see that. I want to talk to you about one more project before we go and have a beer. Frank Sinatra Jr.
Yes.
Right. So I didn't know about this story at all. Stealing Sinatra is a film about the real life kidnapping event, which took place where he was He wasn't even a kid. He was like 18, 19 years old.
He was 18, 19. It was 1963.
And he was kidnapped by a few guys and held to ransom basically by, you know, we've got your kid, give us some money, and then you can have him back. What a mental story.
Yeah.
Real life.
Well, the crazy part about it, too, is that because of his age, after it happened, the press, like some false witness came forward and said that it was all a press stunt and destroyed Frank Jr.'s career.
Really? Wow.
So the craziest thing, and so
you had the trauma of the event, and then the aftermath that followed.
The real trauma was the aftermath, yeah, because
the shame,
the total shame, and then the question of like, what did his dad think? Did his dad think it was a publicity stunt, or did, you know what I mean? Like,
and the effect that had on their relationship.
Oh,
yeah,
totally.
Man.
I mean, and there's a lot, and it's my connection to that family is kind of odd too, because Frank, my grandfather was a stand-up comedian on my dad's side. And he used to open for Frank Sr. and for Frank Jr.
Wow.
So
what were you telling me about your great uncle as well? Was a famous musician.
Yeah. So
it's in the blood, dude, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's in the blood.
He was a famous close-up magician. He did. He wrote the very first book on close-up magic in 1954.
So he was a big mover and a shaker in that world.
He's notated. He's called the magician who fools magicians because he actually pulled a card trick over on Houdini.
Wow.
In a card shop in New York.
Well, that's some epic lineage there, my friend. It's in the blood.
Yeah.
So how was it William H. Macy and David Arquette were the two kidnappers? What were those dudes like to work? I mean, William H. Macy is one of the greatest actors in the world, I think. David Arquette seems like just one of the coolest humans in the world.
Well, and it was directed by Ron Underwood, who directed City Slickers and Tremors.
Oh, cool.
And so, yeah, the
fun set then?
It was a fun set. I learned a lot from William H. Macy, actually. I remember specifically there was one scene. If you said you just saw the film, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the scene where I'm making my escape and I get to the door and, you know, I basically make my threat. And then William H. Macy is like, cool, how about a cup of Joe first? And so I was doing this scene and I must have done like 10 or 12 takes, and Ron just could not get the performance out of me in this moment. He kept, you know, like just having me do it over, and he would try different things, and I just wasn't nailing what he wanted. And I remember William H. Macy not trying to, you know, he wasn't trying to like butt in and tell me how to do my job, but I, you know, after you see like this kid, I mean, I was a kid at the time, I was only about, you know, 21.
Yeah, yeah.
He gave me like this such great suggestion, and he just said, you know, there's in a bar fight, there's two kinds of guys. And there's like the one guy who he'll yell at you and threaten you and he'll turn red in the face, but he's all bark and he's no bite. And then there's the other guy
that won't say a word,
who'll give you the same threat, but as he's telling you this, he's turning white in the face and he's all bite and no bark.
Mm.
And he was like, in this moment, Ron was trying to get me to be the bite, not the bark. And when he told me that, it was, I was able to kind of go to the outward and then understand that and internalize it. And then I nailed the next take.
Didn't he win an award for his role in that film? Or
I don't know if he won in that film. I'm not sure.
He's just one of those, like, because he's very physically, you know, he's not like a big, intense, powerful kind of in-your-face performer. It's the subtleties, isn't it?
Well, and
there's a real sadness. There's a real innate pain to so many of the great roles that he's done.
He surprised me, actually. I remember we were doing the film, and, you know, I have a pretty good memory, so I can memorize my lines fairly quickly. So it's just always something that I've kind of had on my side. And I remember his assistant came to my trailer and knocked on and said, Mr. Macy would like to rehearse with you for this scene. And would you come over in 20 minutes? Sure, that'd be great. So go over his trailer and we read the scene like once, twice, three times, five times, six, seven times. And then we've done this thing about 10 times. And then William says, or Bill says, I'm so sorry. Do you mind if we just do it a few more times? And it was in that moment that I was like, oh man, he's not great because he's just innately great. He's still working at it.
Yeah.
And I learned a valuable lesson again from, you know, another great actor that, you know, just because you can go out there and nail it and, you know, get a couple of rehearsals in and go do it, you can kind of go past that point and find more depth, which is what he does by just like really working that. And you would think, you know, someone that does great, you're like, oh, they don't have to try as hard. It's easy for them. But he tried harder.
That's a beautiful lesson.
Yeah.
It's great to see you. It's great to catch up.
Dude, this has been amazing.
We've got a couple of events which we can, you know, reconnect with in that sense as well. And obviously we're going to go and get drunk tonight. So
yeah, I think I'm going to try to squeeze in my new single during my propaganda DJ set.
Are you going to drop it? Are you going to be doing a full record? Or are you just promoting this new song at the moment?
I have the next single kind of like locked up. I'm just trying to finish the artwork for it. But it's all mixed and mastered and ready to rock.
I think it's the best thing you've done.
Well,
I mean,
wait to hear the next one. The next one kind of sounds like The Laws.
Okay.
So pulling from my UK roots, especially since Johnny Lucas is producing the songs. My idea is I'm playing around with releasing singles this year. You know, everyone keeps saying the album is dead. It's all about the singles anyway. So my idea is I'm going to just drop a bunch of singles until I've compiled enough, and then I'll kind of pull them all together into an album.
Well, ultimately, I think that now people only make albums to promote a tour.
Well, and that's so, the only reason why I make albums is so I can tour.
If that's the case, then why not just do a single and do maybe smaller runs and then just more tours?
That's what I'm doing.
You know, because nobody could put out 12 albums in a year,
right.
But you could put out 10 to 12 singles in a year and do a couple of runs around each one. And
you know, the crazy thing is I was going to drop a single every month.
Yeah, and do that seven into the
month. It's a little bit daunting to get through the promotional side of it, similar to how I would drop an album and I went from working them from like a year to working them for 2 years to now like 3 years. I'll work an album cycle as an independent musician for two, 3 years.
Yep.
So I feel like I'm going to work each single for about 2, 3 months. So that's going to probably be the format. The rollout. So that maybe I'll only release 4 or 5 singles this year. But hey, I haven't released anything since 2017. So
yeah, it's been a minute.
At least I'll put out 4 singles this year.
Because you have all the connections and the hookups, are you somebody who would like to and perhaps have done and are looking to do more of getting songs in films?
Yeah,
Because that's obviously a great platform for so many artists now, I think, because of the decrease in album sales, is a lot of musicians now can get a song in a film. And then that can fund, like, you know, the recording of a whole record, for instance, or can launch a career.
Well, I think it can really launch the song or the career of the artist. I mean, look at the synergy between pop punk and American Pie.
Of course, I mean, those soundtracks must have sold millions of units, right?
Yeah, they're hand in hand. People think of pop punk and they think American Pie, or vice versa.
Yeah.
So.
Didn't you have one of your songs in the soundtrack to the second film? Was it the second film or the wedding?
No, it was Reunion, the fourth one.
It was Reunion,
Yeah, it took me a while.
It took you, you're like, come on, guys, right? This is number four.
I kept trying to, you know.
Did you try from the second one?
Oh, I tried from the first one. Are you kidding? I mean, I tried on all of them. I kept getting a yes, but then the music supervisor had his own thing in mind.
Yeah.
And would just kind of, you know, kibosh the idea each time till finally I just played a live show. The live show got me the song in the fourth one.
Nice.
Not they ask. I didn't ask. I just played the show. And then they asked me.
Right on. There you go. So we should talk about that finally before we go. The reunion film. Was it like a 10-year gap?
13.
13-year gap.
From the first. So I guess 10 from the third.
10 from American Pie 3 Wedding.
Yeah.
So are you guys in touch during that time? Do you maintain relationships? Because I've spoke to a lot of actors that have worked in these kind of projects that go on over many years. And it's quite a unique situation, I think, because you grow up together. You come through together. And often I find that people do remain personally in touch. Did you guys maintain and...
Yeah, I mean, not to the point of like...
Nurture those friendships in the intermittent years, or...
We don't have like our own little reunions.
Got a WhatsApp group or anything.
No, I've created a couple of groups when I've been trying to get people together for, you know, an event or something. Or you know, now I've done Comic-Cons with Shannon and Tara and Mina. Obviously got this one coming up in Liverpool with Shannon and Tara and Chris Klein, who's now doing his first ever. And there was a moment where Jason was going to come, but he's busy working. Eddie almost was going to come, but he pretty much will only go where Jason goes.
Really? When was the last time all of you were in a room together?
You know, I missed that last reunion. There was I was actually playing a show in Philly,
right?
And they did that Entertainment Tonight reunion. It was like, I think Natasha, Tara, Jason, Chris, Sean, and Eddie, I think, and Allison. So I missed that one. But, you know, got to work.
You have got to work. And you can't dine out on the past, of course, you know, because if you do, then you're stagnant and you're not moving forward. But
well, that's where, like, I understand.
Are you proud of your involvement in that franchise and that project?
Oh, for sure. But I am definitely focused on the future. I mean, I don't mind doing, you know, Comic-Con events and talking about those films, but I also do those things so I can talk about the new projects.
What's going on here right now?
Yeah, because that's probably the number one question that I get at, you know, special events is, oh, well, what are you working on now?
What have you been doing since American Pie?
Right. Well, it's kind of like what's coming up next, because unless you have like a Marvel movie that's being rammed down your throat.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big world. There's a lot of entertainment right now.
Do you find it's hard for the film industry in the same way that it is for the music industry, because there is so much white noise to fight through? Like, is promoting films, if you're not, as you say, a big budget Hollywood blockbuster, is it a hustle? Is it a struggle?
Is it hard
trying to find the audience? And
It's a challenge for sure. But I mean, I think that challenges exist on all fronts for any size budget.
And always have.
Yeah. I mean, you know, There's a freedom with independent where you have more control, and then in the studio world, you lose that freedom for the sake of, you know, distribution.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause now you've got someone telling you, oh no, you can't do it that way. You got to do it this way.
Yep.
Versus the independent, you get to do whatever you want.
And of course, you want as many people to see the film as possible. So sometimes do you have to make those concessions to ultimately get the film out to a wider audience and see that as part of the greater goal?
It's a struggle, isn't it? If you play to the audience, then you're never really going to go anywhere, in my opinion.
Amen. Yeah.
Because I think it's all, like, even this new single, I used to write songs to like try to get on the radio.
Yeah.
Now I don't care.
Yeah.
Cool. Someone wants to play it. They want to play it on the radio. They want to play it on a podcast. They don't want to play it. I don't care. Like, I'm just going to write something that I think is good, that I enjoy listening to, and it will find whatever audience it will be, whether it's 5 people, 50 people, 5,000, whatever. It doesn't matter, because I'm all about doing the live show, because the live experience is the thing.
That's the best.
That you can't ever replace. The live show will never go away.
What's your favorite live gig you've ever done?
You know, I was just talking about
this
recently.
Have you ever played at the Wrigley Stadium sort of Chicago Cubs games?
We've talked about it.
It's got to happen, surely.
Yeah.
Come out, do an opening pitch.
There was a time about like 10 years ago where there was a talk about it, but then when the city ordinances changed their rules, they can only have so many concerts.
Right.
So I'm not sure unless I do become the next Foo Fighters, I may not have the chance. Or if I jam with the Foo Fighters the next time they play at Wrigley, then
I've heard you do Foo Fighters on more than one occasion. You do the songs very well.
One day Dave Grohl is going to send me a big old invoice for how many times I've played Everlong, his music. Yeah, exactly.
That's the go-to. Favorite gig ever, and we'll end on that note.
You know, my favorite gig was actually the smallest gig I've ever played.
So they're often the best.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, my first gig was the largest gig. It was like, you know, 6,000 people when I was like 16 years old. But my favorite gig of all time was 2011 in Germany on a Sunday. It was a music house. And the owner of the music house, who lived upstairs and the bar was downstairs, was really grouchy when we got there. And he, you know, was part of the rider that he made us dinner, and he shows us the newspaper, and he turns on the radio, and there's an advertisement with my song playing, and he is showing me these posters that he got printed, and he's like telling me about all this advertisement that he did, and he's angry because he's only got 4 pre-sales. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I guess, you know, Sunday's not a good day. It's Sunday roast, you know. It's not a good day to have a concert in, like, the middle of nowhere, Germany. And so gig time comes around. We've done our sound check, and we've eaten our food. And he comes into the back room to the green room, and he goes, "So, do you want to cancel?"
In a very German way. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, well, why? And he says, "Well, you've got 4 pre-sales, and there are 4 people here. And that's it." I was like, "So they're the 4 people that bought the tickets?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "So they showed up. They want to see the show." And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, then let's give them a show." And then he kind of stopped and he looked at me a little differently. He expected that I was going to say, "Let's cancel it." So we go out there and we put on the show. And at the end of the show, I bring like all 4 people together to the front table. I come off the stage and I jam an acoustic like Bruce Springsteen song right there. And it turns out that one of the guys was this Russian guy. He had such a great time at the concert that he became an investor of the venue. And unbeknownst to me, the reason the guy was so angry is because his venue was going out of business. And he was doing everything that he could to bring people there, and it wasn't working, including with our show. And so this one show for these 4 people saved his business.
That's like a Hollywood movie story.
And then he was like my best friend. So he went from being this, you know, grouchy man that was angry with me to just like having like this love and respect. And then he was just like giving me gifts, and he made his own coffee and had his own like coffee plants with the berries and like got the seeds out and like gave me a bag of this and made his own jelly. And he, "Here, you take this with you." And it was just like the evening turned around. And that was my favorite show.
Everybody loves a happy ending.
Yeah.
Dude, I love you. Great to see you.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for a cool chat. And let's go get a beer, shall we? You ready?
I'm ready.
Is it time?
It's time!
It's been 1 week since you looked at me. Cocked your head to the side and said I'm angry. 5 days since you laughed at me, saying get back together, come back and see me. 3 days since the living room, I realized it's all my fault, but couldn't tell you. Yesterday, you'd forgiven me, but it'll still be 2 days till I say I'm sorry.
Hold it, now we'll watch a hoodwink. Does it make you stop, think? You'll think you're looking at Aquaman. I summon fish to the dish, although I like the chalet Swiss. I like the sushi cause it's never touch a frying pan. Hot like wasabi when I bust rhymes. Speak like Leanne rhymes because I'm all about value. Bert Kemper's got the mad hits. You try to match